This is tape one, side two. Well, let's move into your affiliation with NACA, the NACA, how that came about, and the kinds of work that you did there.
Well, I was a member of the committee, and I was also chairman of one of the subcommittees. I think it was the one on structures.
Right.
Wernher von Braun was on my committee, for example. And
at what time then did you hook up with the NACA?
That was the middle of the 50s. I was on there for, I guess it was a total of 10 years. I'd have to look it up to be sure. Because I was elected for the balance of one term, and then I was re-elected for another term. And, well, about all I did there was sit in on the committee meetings and go on the visits that they made to the various research centers, participate in briefings or listen to briefings and so forth and so on. And Hugh Dryden was really the technical man, and Jerry Hunsaker was the chairman. And Jerry would sit at the middle of the table, and Hugh Dryden at one end, and John Victory would sit at the side of Jerry Hunsaker and see that he didn't do something wrong according to the rules and regulations. And I guess, how many? There were about 10 or 15 members of that committee, and I remember that Orville Wright came to one of those meetings.
Generally, what was your input into the committee?
We had an agenda, and we went down through the agenda, and once in a while we did something that was worthwhile, but generally speaking, I think it was just another set of committee meetings, which, as I say, sometimes aren't terribly necessary. After they've been in existence for a long time, they get into a routine. You sort of felt that there was a certain amount of prestige in being on that committee, and Jerry Hunsaker was a very, well, he wasn't austere, but he was a gentleman. And he handled things in a tactful way. And he was a good man to meet with the heads of similar organizations in other countries. And we had some of that. So I remember those days as when I only got into technical matters as a subcommittee chairman on structures.
Okay, before we talk about your subcommittee work, before 1955 when you came on with NACA, and then we're at Douglas, What was your perception of the value of NACA, of its ability? Or,
well, NASA was very valuable to us on the DC-3 or the DC-1, of course, because the industry didn't have very much in the way of wind tunnels, and NASA was doing a lot of research on airfoils and on configurations and on power plant development, and things that were developed within NASA, we utilized on the DC-1. And same time, we did do wind tunnel work at Caltech, as you know. The amount of commercial work that NASA could take on in its tunnels was limited. They did some.
did you feel, in, say, in the period after World War II, that that NACA was promoting the science of aeronautics in a way that would help industry? Was there a sense of a close relationship there?
Oh, yeah.
Can you explain that a little
bit? Oh, sure. Well, George Lewis was heading it up at one time there, and he had good prestige, and the organization had a very good reputation. Of course, at that time, it was not doing any contract research or contracts outside of NASA. It did it in-house, except for very, very minor things. And that was a great big shift when NASA came along. And these big centers had to take on contract work in addition to research work, so forth, so on. But NEC organization, I think, always was thought of well in industry as very helpful in those days, and very necessary.
You say in those days. What is that?
Well, as time went on, as I said before, the larger companies in the industry increased the amount of their research facilities. They got wind tunnels of their own. Boeing had a big one there named for Eddie Allen. And others developed them too. And also, some of the fundamentals had been pretty well established. You knew pretty well how to design an airfoil from scratch. And I would say that the industry didn't depend as much on NACA in those later days. But nevertheless, it continued to have a good reputation.
Just to get your reaction to a comment that, that Bob Gilruth made to mm-hmm. us, is that he felt after the dropping of the bomb at the end of World War II that a noticeable kind of philosophic change came over the Air Force, that there wasn't as great a commitment to advancing aeronautical research, producing a quality tactical craft, that there, I guess you might say, their attention was diverted by consideration about how to use the
bomb. Well, you'll find when you read these papers here that one of the things that Jim wanted me to get into aeronautical research.
Right.
And it was a problem then because space was in the forefront and some of these other things were in the forefront. And there wasn't enough budget available to do as much as they used to do. But at the same time, they weren't depended upon as much by industry. Now, what I did do for Jim was get in touch with various companies and had them send in lists of what they thought NASA should be doing or that it wasn't doing.
Right,
and what facilities were necessary. You probably read that.
Right.
So that was a continuing concern with Jim. And I'm sure that the industry felt from the answers that they gave that NASA wasn't doing enough. And the that older type of research work.
Yeah, I just thought Dr. Gilruth's statement was interesting because it came well before the he was thinking of the period well before the establishment of NASA, but just the whole strategic picture with the bomb had changed and therefore had given a different cast to,
sure,
to aeronautical research.
Sure,
I thought that was a very interesting comment.
Yeah. Of course, we did some research at RAND. But it was never possible to get the superlative engineers at RAND, because that wasn't the kind of a job where they were really doing something they could see with their own hands afterwards, because RAND never built anything. Right. On the other hand, at Aerospace, they were able to get some pretty darn good engineering people over there. And they did get into, do get into, operations, although they don't go into any contract work. They're oversee contract work.
Let's talk a little bit about your work on the subcommittee on structures then. What kinds of problems were you grappling with? What were the activities of the subcommittee?
Tell you the truth, I really don't remember very much. And I wonder if I've got anything here that would tell me. I attended meetings, and this little group went through the process of saying what they thought NASA was doing, that it shouldn't be doing, or what it wasn't doing that it should be doing, and making kind of recommendations periodically when we had meetings.
You mean NACA?
I mean NACA.
Right.
Yeah, that's right.
What kinds of concerns came under the rubric of structures? What kinds of problems were you worried about there?
Well, that's what I'm trying to remember now, because it bothers me a little bit, because it seems to me that Ron Hazen, who was an engine man, was part of that committee. I know Werner von Braun was.
Yeah, that's why I'm asking. It seems like your concern was more than just aircraft structures, but perhaps...
Seems to me so, too, as I look back on it, but I may be getting my times a little bit mixed up as far as years are concerned.
Okay.
It's not on the tip of my tongue. It's been a long time ago, and I just don't remember too much about it.
That's fine. Well, if some of these things come to mind later, then we can talk about them.
Sure.
Let's sort of look at the end of your tenure at Douglas as we move up into the late 50s and towards 1960. What kinds of things are you? I mean, you've been at Douglas a number of years. When did you begin to think about retiring and for what reasons? You indicated that the administrative burden or the amount of pressure that you were under at that time was pretty significant.
Yeah, well, I've written it up in here fairly well, but I did have certainly a semi-nervous breakdown, which was about 1957. And I didn't want to continue under the pressure conditions indefinitely. I felt that, in fact, I thought for quite a while that about 1960 I should retire and not wait until 65 or anything like that. And it was also true that you could see the future to some extent, because Don Jr. was coming along and being groomed to be president, and he was going to want to have some of his people come in on the thing, and it would be a different organization after that, and that all transpired and happened. My relationship with him was perfectly reasonable, but his relationship with some people was not very reasonable, and a lot of people left the company when he came in.
What time was that?
That was... Let's see, I'd have to look that up again, but it was 57 or thereabouts, 56. And it was a case where, I sort of was sorry for him, because should he stay in the background, not try to move forward? Or should he try to move forward and be accused of not being capable in that position, but only being in that position because of his father, you see? It's this old nepotism problem that is often a problem. And he wasn't universally liked to work for, anyway. But that wasn't the reason that I left. The reason that I left was really what I said, namely that as soon as the DC-8 was finished, I felt that I'd been there 35 years, and I was getting to the point where I didn't have to be there any longer, and I was getting interested in other things, too. And it was just time to move on. And I did want to see Ed Burton come in on my job because he'd been a chief engineer for so very long. And unfortunately, after he got the job, he only lived about 3 years.
Were the pressures that you were feeling at that time, were they sort of the normal sort of administrative pressures that go along with the position, or were there just special problems that had cropped up in the company that were very
taxing? It really hinged on the DC-8 in general. Those were the additional pressures. There were some internal problems about people who got along well together and people who didn't get along well together and so forth and so on, but that created some pressure for me once because I had a chief engineer down at Long Beach who I valued highly. And he was a gentleman. He was a very nice guy. But we had trouble with one of those airplanes, one of those Air Force airplanes down there, of a technical nature. And the trouble got more severe and they didn't get out of it. And the Air Force even threatened to cancel part of the order. And I'd been heavily involved in the DC-8, and I didn't pay too much attention to it because I had a lot of confidence in this guy. Well, Doug made up his mind due to information that came to him from various sources that he had to move in and see that this guy was replaced. And he chose the replacement without talking to me about it. And then he went and left town and left me a letter telling me I'd better do it. Well, that was pretty hard to take because I had to talk to the guy who was an old friend of mine. And I had to move this other guy forward when a lot of people didn't like him. And that was an additional pressure, but those things didn't happen very often. In fact, that's the only case that I can remember. But the DC-8 was enough pressure anyway, because you had, you were in the position where you couldn't build a prototype. You had to start building production right away. And there had to be a number of airplanes on the line before the first one flew. So if you got into some really serious difficulty, you really were in deep, deep trouble. We were lucky enough to get through that.
You mentioned that you were, during this period of the latter 50s, also developing other interests besides NACA. What were you referring to there?
Well, that was a period when Dottie and I got interested in foreign students at UCLA. She got me into it more or less, but I got extremely interested in it. And what her little group were doing at UCLA was trying to get foreign students to the point where they liked the United States, so that when they went back to their own countries, they would be favorably inclined towards this country. And we tried to provide things for them that the university couldn't provide, which was a home away from home, friendly people. And it really became a relationship where a lot of people, a lot of students started calling us mom and father. And we had a foster family, and they were spread all over the world. And we wanted to travel and get out and see them at their homes. And I traveled quite a bit for Douglas, but I was limited to the places where I went on business and could combine business and a little pleasure. So this all came to a head about the same time, and during the 60s when I was working for Jim Webb and these other things, we did an awful lot of travel. Went around the world. There wasn't any continent that we didn't visit except the South Pole. And that wasn't work. That was beginning to retire in a way, or set up a retirement. And those are other interests.
Okay. I think we're about ready to, you know, yeah, move into the post-Douglas period.
Yeah.
Just in way of summary, as you look back on your Douglas career, mm-hmm, at that point, what sort of strengths did you feel like you'd acquired, mm-hmm, during your tenure there, and how did you sort of see yourself taking those into the future and perhaps doing consulting like you did for Mr. Webb, as well as went into the Aerospace Corporation?
Yeah, I didn't want to retire entirely. I did want to continue to make use of my experience, but I decided I wouldn't work for any competitive company. I did get some jobs to do for American Airlines after I retired, but that wasn't a competitive company. They didn't build airplanes. And that was done with Doug's approval, and I don't think anybody objected. I worked for C.R. Smith on two things. First place was the, I think we called it the 808 at Consolidated. And it was built on account of Howard Hughes getting into TWA and not liking Douglas or Lockheed and wanting to push Convair into this sort of thing. They nearly lost their shirt. But anyway, the 808 was deficient in performance when it first came out. And C.R. Smith got a hold of me and said, I wanted to know if I'd go down there and see whether the corrections they were making would, in my opinion, correct. If so, how much? So this was shortly after I retired. And I went down to San Diego 8 or 9 times, spent some time there and looked into what they were doing and so forth. And I thought they were doing a good job, and they did. Actually, they picked up that performance remarkably well. I think there may be only one thing that they didn't meet finally in the specifications, something like landing speed or something of that sort. And then later on, not very much later on, CR had gotten into a contract with the British to furnish some airplanes, BAC-111s. And they had a fatal accident over in England in testing it when the plane got into a flat spin and the pilot didn't realize he couldn't get it out of that, and the just plane crashed. And so they got a hold of me, and they wanted to know if I'd go over there and look into it and see if the corrections they were making would actually correct, and again, the same kind of a job. I looked into it, and I decided that I thought they would, and I told them so, and actually they did, and they had him in service for quite a while. They never had an accident of that sort. They didn't keep him in service terribly long because other things came along to supplant them. So with the exception of those two things, all that I did was really in the non-profit sector or the things like RAND.
Both of those instances, it seems like you were providing more technical expertise than management expertise.
Yeah, although I did get into management questions at RAND. I was on the committee at Aerospace that passed on salaries, compensation committee. And that was certainly management. It wasn't technical.
Well, let's begin to consider some of your activities after 1960. You became a consultant to Frank Kolbaum for the RAND Corporation. Mm-hmm. When did you come in contact with the Aerospace Corporation and begin to work with them?
The next day after I retired, Manny Schriever said he wanted to see me, and he got me in his office, and he said that they were going to form something like Aerospace. They didn't have a name for it yet, to get away from the conflict of interest problem that it had with DRW. And would I take a job as chairman of this organization? And I immediately said no, because that would get me right back into the same thing I'd been in before. And however, I said I'd be very happy to help, and I'd be willing to serve on the board, but not as a chairman. So I did, and I became member of the board from the very original part of it. And I stayed on it until, 12 years, because then I became 72, and they had a mandatory retirement thing of 72. So that, I got in right away. And, of course, within a year, I'd gotten into the thing with Jim Webb. Right. And then shortly after that, I got into the research analysis trustee problem. And that was the Army's RAND back in McLean, Virginia. Omar Bradley was the chairman of the board when I went in there first. And they were a little like RAND. They were a lot smaller. They had a very specific research program which was laid down by the Army, and they couldn't deviate from it very much. So they did such things as conflict analysis and this and that, that sort of thing. And I did, on the board, get into the same kind of things that other boards had gotten into, which were of a management nature. And also the fact that I was on the aerospace board and I was working with RAND. These were all nonprofits.
Right.
Made it possible for me to help RAC a little bit in its complications with the Army, where the Army wanted to cut their fee and they wanted to do this and that and the other thing. But they ultimately gave up as a nonprofit and they were absorbed by one of the technical companies. RAND almost got caught in the grinder on account of Daniel Ellsberg, Pentagon Papers.
A little bit later, yeah.
Yeah, but that was later. But it was while I was there.
I'm not too familiar with the early history of the Aerospace Corporation.
Mm-hmm.
What were the set of circumstances that, that motivated Trever to set this thing up?
Well, it was a possible conflict of interest because TRW, Thompson Raymond Woolridge, was a contractor, and they built things for their customer. And when Trever took over the ballistic missile division for the Air Force and had his offices over in Arbor Vitae, over in the El Segundo area, he was building a kind of a organization that was responsible for, well, an architect-engineer relationship with the contractors, just as aerospace got into later. But it was a contractor at the same time, you see. And it was an incipient sort of a thing, and it was criticism and this and that. And there were boards who considered the matter. Clark Millikan was on one of them. And so they decided that it would be a good idea to make a nonprofit, a new one, establish one, that would take over from what was in STL. And thus, it would have nothing to do with placement of contracts, choice of contractors, or any of that sort of thing. So that was the origin of Aerospace Corporation, and they've had some pretty prestigious members on their boards. Vice President, I mean, ex-President Ford was on it until recently. And Lucius Clay was on it.
What kinds of things did you contribute as a member of the board of directors?
Well, I just contributed advice as one of the board. And they had briefings, very good ones usually, because they were pretty good at that sort of thing. And we'd keep abreast of what was going on. But it was more, the board got into matters of organization and management. And the Air Force would complain that aerospace had not the proper levels of authority, or it had too many people in this and not enough people in that, and this, that, and the other thing. They dug into the management an awful lot. And when Congress got in on the thing and said they were paying salaries that were too high and serving gourmet meals and so forth, why, there were things like that that did come before the board. They were not, I'd say, very valid criticisms, because aerospace was in competition with other companies for men. And they had to have awfully good men, and they had to pay good salaries in order to get them. And they had to have an environment that attracted them. So the fact that they had a gourmet meal for the executive really didn't amount to rubber shucks as far as total cost is concerned. And it wasn't so terribly gourmet at that, but it was more than a cafeteria. But it's the little things that count with Congress so often, because they can understand them.
How would you compare the kinds of activities and purpose of aerospace with RAND? I mean, we're both essentially think tank organizations.
Well, aerospace has laboratories. It's quite a fact, a great big laboratory building over there now. And RAND has never had laboratories. aerospace was in direct contact with the major space contractors. And those contractors relied on aerospace a good deal for critical evaluation of what the contractors were doing. Rand never did that particularly. Rand was, they overlapped to some extent, but the emphasis was different.
Okay. Is there any other?
There's nothing particular to aerospace, for example, having to do with social sciences.
Right.
Economics.
That was, that activity didn't really begin to blossom at Rand until the 60s as well.
Right.
That, yeah.
Right.
Okay, let's, before we move to Mr. Webb, let's talk about your consultant activity with Frank Kaulbaum. How did that relation evolve now that you had more time? You said during the 50s, pretty much, you didn't really have the time to touch base with him, even on an informal level.
Well, my contract with Rand was... it called for a certain number of hours per quarter, I think, something like that. And it didn't require me to be in the office certain hours of the day, every day of the week, something like that. So I had a considerable amount of freedom to travel or to do other things, providing it was okay with Frank and with, didn't interfere with anything I was doing there. And I was valiantly trying to become sufficiently aware of the Rand program and its totality to be able to give some worthwhile advice as to whether there should be some additional emphasis here or less emphasis there and so forth and so on. I did try to do that. And... it meant an awful lot of reading of reports, attending meetings and listening to what people said and so forth and so on. Generally speaking, I think I was accepted by the organization without any great enthusiasm or any great distaste. Most of them didn't see that I was doing very much, I think. And actually... I didn't come out with a lot of writing and a lot of reports and so forth. I did what I could based upon what I knew, and I was busy. I'd been there for several years when I felt that the question of relations with industry was much less important than it was at the beginning when I went in first. And... that was one thing I got into in the first with Rand, as I did with NASA.
When you say relations with industry, you mean
what industry thought of Rand,
okay.
And what industry thought Rand could contribute,
okay.
And whether they felt that it was, they wished it wasn't around, so forth and so on.
Okay, let's take a brief break here while I put in a new tape.
Got another one, huh?